This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Friday, June 10th, 2022. I'm Caleb Brown. As states and even some regulatory bodies begin to recognize the potential benefits of psychedelics as medical treatments, there are some big risks ahead. William Leonard Pickard is a psychedelics researcher. We discuss the regulatory and political pitfalls that may lie ahead for the attempt to move psychedelics into mainstream medicine.
Let's begin here, and we'll get some of the backstory in a bit. But what do you see as the opportunity in psychedelic research and medical treatment today?
The opportunity for psychedelic treatment today would be to ensure that clinical trials are not only efficacious, truly efficacious to overcome FDA barriers, but that there are no untoward events from improper vetting of patients, patients who clinically present who are perhaps should not be there, that they are a proper fit for the drug and the mode of treatment.
So what stands in the way?
Our ignorance presently, because of the long, dark period of no government-funded research for the last 40 years, little is known. But other than anecdotal reports from the underground, and of course the great work at Hopkins, by Roland Griffith and Matt Johnson and colleagues there established a standard of great value, published in the Journal of Psychopharmacology and well vetted by distinguished colleagues. And that established and really launched the entire field.
One of the problems that people identify about various drugs that could be useful clinically is that so many of these drugs aren't owned. That is to say, the chemical structures, they exist, and they've existed for a long time. And so it's hard for a pharmacological, big pharma, so-called, to make a buck. And so they don't fund the research. They look for something that they can derive exclusive revenues from over time. And that seems to be a problem in psychedelics in particular.
Well, of course, there's a great debate in the psychedelic and medical communities about the divisiveness, frankly, among those that wish to patent some variant of a already well-known, ages-old botanical. Patents exclude materials which are already obvious or known to the community. The psychedelic companies, like Big Pharma, try to get around this by doing exotic changes on the molecule. For example, psilocybin has been established since its discovery in the early 50s and its synthesis by Albert Hofmann and others. The way that psychedelic companies have approached it is to attempt to patent various crystalline lattices, if you will, polymorphs, as they're called, of psilocybin. So they're not really patenting psilocybin itself, but a crystalline form. Another approach is they use minor radioactive variants, deuterated, as it's called, using deuterium. These are ploys that have been done by Big Pharma for many years in an attempt to patent, if they will, essentially unpatentable items or to make new claims on already patented drugs. So we're seeing this replayed out in the psychedelic industry. There recently was a lawsuit really filed against Compass Pathways in England, which is attempting to patent a polymorph of psilocybin. Quite successfully, the patent office issued the patent. And now they've run into an adversarial activist group, Freedom to Operate, which has challenged them in federal court. So the district courts and thereafter the appellate courts in the next 3, 4, 5 years will decide, frankly, a good part of the future of the industry. are natural drugs, psilocybin, LSD, mescaline, patentable using these unusual techniques, or are they not? And so Big Pharma will respond very favorably or unfavorably to these. It'll be the Wild West of a psychopharmacology in the next few years.
So these seem like, if I understand you correctly, these seem like internal struggles among groups that would like to see clinical therapeutic use of these drugs. Is that right?
That is correct. And we will see clinical trials, perhaps not in the U.S. immediately, but in Canada, quite underway, and around the world. There are perhaps 200 different clinical trials ongoing as we speak around the world. And we anticipate the outcomes of some of the early players, the MDMA work on PTSD among veterans, the application of psilocybin for depression. We expect those results in the next year to 18 months. And those outcomes as well will define the industry. I think the important point, though, in these clinical trials is if FDA is to approve a substance, it must be more effective, more efficacious for treatment of a particular malady than the existing treatment. Now, that's kind of a high bar, because for a decade or so, we've had SSRIs, for example, for a treatment of depression, and $1 billion has been put into studying the mechanisms of action, the neurology, the biochemistry of these compounds, lots of drug design, and they've been specifically developed to approach depression. Whereas now we're picking from the botanical panorama these exotic psychedelic drugs that may or may not work, but look very promising in the early stages. So there's great hope that these will be effective. But again, it's a very high bar to overcome the FDA level of efficacy required for approval. Maybe 17% of all big pharma drugs are approved. So very few get over that bar. Will psychedelics make it? I hope that we'll have new medicines, psychedelic or non-psychedelic. I hope that we'll have continual evolution of good medicines for these very sad diseases. If it's a psychedelic, great. If not, that's okay too.
I have read, and perhaps you can correct my understanding here, that some of the early studies on psychedelics, perhaps it was psilocybin or MDMA, on people who had PTSD were extremely promising, like almost stunning results.
That's correct. Some of the early work, indeed out of Hopkins, and some of the early MDMA reports indicate a level of improvement over current treatment paradigms that is more than statistically significant, more than a few percent. They are profoundly profound advance, and so it's really a new paradigm in treatment. These drugs aren't taken in a pill form every day as though you would an SSRI, but administered rather than in chronic form, in an acute form under the presence of a therapist. They're not subtle, not I don't feel anything, but generally lifting a mood over a few months. They are intense, emotional, deep experiences. It's an entirely different treatment protocol. Big Pharma, I'm sure, is quite curious about this phenomenon, especially if it could displace their investments over the past decades.
Let's go back in time a little bit. You mentioned the dark ages of this psychopharmacological research. There was a time when the only government body that was doing any research in psychedelics may well have been the CIA.
Yes, I just left Tyson's Corner this morning, not CIA headquarters, but they were certainly nearby. Right. This early CIA work, the Project MK Ultra, was designed to use to weaponize certain psychedelics, not in the sense of lethality, but in the sense of being useful interrogation methods for hostile foreign agents to extract data and information from them. And those were carried on for quite a few years from the 50s when CIA first discovered these materials up through the Church Committee, Frank Church's committee in 72, which disbanded the government's chemical efforts. But that's not to say that the government doesn't have a continuing interest in these fields. DOD for quite some years among warfighters has been looking for useful agents for that have anti-fatigue properties. They've even looked at classes of compounds which might enhance memory, called ampicines, and supported research at in California at Gary Lynch's lab, looking at materials that might improve cognitive performance or cognitive ability on the battlefield, being able to handle many different information inputs and assessments of the theater and how to perform, anti-stress agents. Even DARPA now currently is funding $10 and $20 million research efforts looking at ways of taking the psychedelic out of promising psychedelics, MDMA analogs that are effective in treating PTSD, but versions that don't have a psychedelic effect. There's a great deal of interest in that area. In other words, DARPA acknowledges that certain drugs may have healing properties useful to soldiers, but they don't care for the as they say, deleterious mental effects. And so they're trying to separate that. The question is, can it be separated? Can you separate a healing effect from what one might consider a long night of the soul? That's quite debatable. So we shall see how that turns out in the next few years.
What did, for lack of a better term, the industry, the psychedelic industry, look like in the 1960s and 1970s?
Okay, you're speaking of the underground industry, the illegal, illicit industry, that which operated outside of government regulation. And of course, that's 99.9% of all psychedelic compounds ever used worldwide. We're excluding indigenous tribes' use of things like mescaline, the tarahumara, for example, in Mexico, or various parts of the world, the Native American church use of mescaline, the Zapotec in Oaxaca's use of psilocybin, and a range of similar actions throughout South America. The New World, psychedelics are a New World phenomenon. The underground status in the 60s in terms of non-indigenous use was a series of single individuals, underground acid chemists, the first acid chemist. A number of them died in prison during the period when FDA was in control of matters. But a DEA was formed about 72. Around that time, before that time, there was, it was BNDD. The earliest acid chemist of note was Augustus Owsley Stanley III, a Kentucky senator's grandson, I believe, who produced 400 grams of LSD in San Francisco. That's a million doses. And this went out all over Northern California, LA, and Laguna Beach and points east. And that was followed by a rather serious scaling up to several kilograms made by the underground chemists Nicholas Sand and Tim Scully of the distribution group, the Brotherhood of Eternal Love. That went out, of course, in Northern California, across the United States, and across Europe, Paris, Rome, parts of Asia, South America, a worldwide phenomenon. And that was distributed in the form of orange barrels, they were called, little tablets, swirly orange barrels with 240 micrograms of LSD in each one, which is actually quite a substantial dose. The average dose these days is about 60 micrograms, enough for aesthetic enhancement, the beauty of trees, the walking with friends, philosophical conversations, that sort of thing, nothing too challenging, but beautiful in its own way, some say.
To what extent could we draw a line between the desired outcomes of people who were seeking out these drugs then and people who might be seeking the kinds of treatment that these drugs could provide today?
Well, it's entirely two different groups. You know, in the 60s, people were seekers. No one over 30 knew anything about these materials. Ginsberg, a few beats, were aware of them, but hence the term, don't trust anyone over 30. But first generation, certainly my generation, I was 21, 22 at the time, when there was a great wave of visitors and young people coming to San Francisco, hence the term, if you're going to San Francisco, wear flowers in your hair. The music of the time changed remarkably. It's a great period of social revolution. There's changes in not only music, but in poetry and writing and science and medicine. Politics, particularly the period of marching against the war in Vietnam. Of course, the government was very concerned because they equated marijuana and psychedelic use with civil unrest, and that could have been part of the reason for the making the illegality of LSD in 66. So, yes, there were, of course, two different groups, today's group versus the groups then. And those days, it was primarily young people, all of a single generation, seeking out of curiosity what this remarkable new neurochemical would do. They thought it might end war, end materialist values, a type of mental stimulant, something that would bring, through neurochemical means, peace and love, if you will, throughout society, kind of returning us to our more natural origins and away from the machine-like militaristic direction in which they saw society moving, particularly with the Vietnam War. Today's group, since the current framework is the medical model, being the only way that one could get government approval, you get through FDA, is not to claim we want to dance in the street or walk in the moonlight, but we have people that are having problem with neuroses or marital problems or autism or depression, and we think these drugs may be useful. And so the cohort of users these days, excluding the continuing underground use, which goes on as we speak, the new above ground visible cohort are people seeking treatment for their depression or for their anxiety or a variety of psychiatric maladies. That's quite a unusual phenomenon and very, very different from the 60s because in the 60s, if a person, a friend, a young person came up and they were depressed or they were anxious or they were skitsy or they were having some bipolar bit or somehow they were off, the unwritten rule was you don't give these compounds, these powerful substances to such people, because they might find themselves in a painful situation and you might find yourself up all night trying to handle the behavioral outcomes from it. So that was a good rule and was pretty effective for the last 40 years. But now, in order to use these drugs legally, one has to present with a medical problem or a quasi-medical problem. That means the exposure to people that in the past would never be given these drugs. That's going to be quite interesting to see how the clinical trials bear out, if people are vetted significantly so that we don't have unusual behavioral manifestations during clinical trials. The media would immediately seize on that.
In the 1970s and 1980s, there were scientists who were attempting to, in some ways, legitimize research in this field. For a lot of them, if I understand your argument, is that these people faced the ends of their careers if they were to make public the fact that they had an interest in this kind of research.
Absolutely. And that period of seeing psychedelics as marginalized or fringe or ridiculous only ended a few years ago with the Roland Griffiths' great work at Hopkins. And also, frankly, through the seminal efforts of Rick Doblin at MAPS, a colleague actually at the Kennedy School of Government. Rick was some years ahead of me, but I can recall when MAPS was originally organized and moving forward, and great barriers were faced in getting people to listen or not discard the concept immediately as too exotic or inappropriate. If you said the word psychedelic or showed any interest in it in an academic field, you were immediately marginalized and excluded. So now, of course, it's the potential darling of the psychiatric community, and many careers are arising from it and focusing on it, and it looks like that's going to go on for quite a number of years more. Indeed, it may be a favorable revolution. My personal feeling on this, having lived in this space daily for 55 years, is that 80% or more of existing corporations that are attempting to medicalize will either fail or merge or be acquired. I think that it's a period of great enthusiasm, and perhaps too much enthusiasm. But that said, that many will survive, and we will have extremely promising new medicines of great value.
Are there any concerns that you have? You sort of laid out, I think, a couple of them, of the commercialization of psychedelics, because I know there is immense interest on Wall Street of the potential of these drugs to treat people.
Well, of course, Wall Street sees the figures, which are indeed most promising themselves until the recent correction in the S&P in December and forward, and a similar correction in biotech sector as well. And psychedelics perhaps took the stronger hit, being the new guy on the block and perhaps overvalued. But of course, Wall Street's interest is most cordially invited, and major investors are looking very carefully, or have already placed large bets favorably in the field. It's just I hope that the investment community has a staying power to get through this this correction and hold on through the clinical trials and watch those outcomes. It's a very heady, very exciting period. I never thought I would see it in my lifetime, frankly.
And you made mention of some of the concerns that you had with regard to individuals who, in the 60s, it would have been well known not to give these people these very powerful drugs, who will nonetheless be in a medical setting, would be potentially given these drugs. And if anything goes wrong, or if the results of this testing goes badly, then you can imagine certain lawmakers on Capitol Hill and elsewhere seizing on that opportunity.
Yes, I'm sure that can happen. And, you know, it just takes a few newsworthy incidents, whatever, to help that media focus come alive. But perhaps the beauty of it is that these compounds, even though profound, are frankly remarkably safe. You know, there are 20,000 deaths a year from aspirin. And if that were applied to psychedelics, they would be demonized even more than they have been. But remarkably, they tend to be generally quite non-toxic. The legacy compounds, LSD, mescaline, psilocybin, tend to be non-addictive physically. And also the curious property of being self-limiting. By that I mean cocaine addict or heroin addict craves their substance on a daily basis and often will do anything to get it, hence increases in crime rates in heroin-riddled portions of cities and frantic cocaine addicts running about. But psychedelics tend to provide a type of personal insight during the experience that allows self-termination of the period of use. One looks within and decides one doesn't need a drug anymore and simply stops. And that's an extraordinary property of this class of compounds. So the period of self-limitation, I think, will attenuate any particular negative social changes that might be perceived or arise, and I think those would be rare to see a negative outcome during clinical trial. I'm just pointing out that it's likely that we will see some over time. It's hard to imagine a clinical trial without a negative outcome, but I think things will be all right.
Are there specific changes to the way that drugs are regulated? Or in fact, you know, any medical treatments are regulated that would make this process move more swiftly for the people who might benefit immensely from this kind of medicine?
Well, you know, there are a number of regulatory approaches that are ongoing as we speak. You know, FDA has a fast track program. You know, they have an orphan drug designation. Even DEA has mechanisms for getting a drugs approved or rescheduled properly, and activists are beginning to show up to kind of stimulate those. I know at headquarters here the other day, there was a sort of a lion reminiscent of the 60s, and people were carted away, you know, arguing that they must respond to a letter sent 18 months ago requesting a special permission for those with life-threatening and terminal diseases to, under special conditions, use psilocybin or various psychedelics for healing in their last days. And that's a very compassionate and humanitarian thought. So I think we'll see more and more of that going down, yes.
William Leonard Pickard is a psychedelics researcher we spoke last month. Subscribe to and give a rating to the Cato Daily Podcast on your podcast platform of choice, and follow us on Twitter @CatoPodcast.